listening to More Talk Radio on KBOO. I'm Eric Jorgensen. I'm filling in this morning for Ani Haynes. She's out today. And joining me in the KBOO studio is Courtney Scott. She is the director of a new documentary exposing the secret battle against animals in industry and entertainment and the struggle to gain their rights. It's called The War on Animals. It's coming soon to theaters. Courtney Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
So if we could start out just talking a little bit about the film, what sort of drove you to make the film, a little bit about what the process has been like.
Okay, well, it started about 3 years ago when I first met Matt Roselle from In Defense of Animals. And Matt had done some undercover work at OHSU, Oregon Health Sciences University, where he exposed the treatment of lab animals, in particular monkeys. And after watching that film, I was really disturbed, mostly because of the confinement of these animals. These are, as most people recognize, some of the highest intelligent animals right next to humans. And yet they're confined for maybe 10, 15 years of their life in about a 4-by-6-inch cage. So not only are they experimented on continuously, many times without anesthetic, but they're confined to the point of madness. And I found that extremely disturbing. It stuck with me. And then just slowly I began to learn about more and more animal abuse. It kind of was always in the background. It started coming to the surface. And I began to empathize more with other species and realize what must it be like to be in their paws, so to speak. And I just really wanted to make other people aware, as I had become aware of the issue and what they can do about it.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the undercover work at OHSU?
Oh, yeah. Well, Matt Roselle worked undercover for 2 years in the lab as a lab technician. So he knew exactly what was going on there, and he took video, secretly, of course.
Right.
And after those 2 years, he released this video to the media. And subsequently, there have been a couple of investigations by the USDA, which is the governing body, a regulatory body over lab experimental facilities such as OHSU. However, nothing has really changed there because PETA did another undercover investigation recently, I believe a couple years ago, and the same conditions were still in place for the most part.
Right. Do you know the nature of the kind of science that they're trying to advance through these experiments? Or?
Well, there's different kinds. For instance, they're still doing nicotine studies there on pregnant monkeys. They do a lot of drug testing there.
Nicotine testing as if they're not convinced that nicotine is bad for pregnant
it
women.
It seems, you know, part of what I've gathered from talking to former researchers and doctors who themselves were vivisectors, is a lot of it is driven by the grants. They have enormous money coming in from the NIH, the National Institutes of Health.
Right.
And so this is an ongoing money machine, and it would be awfully hard for a university to turn that down because the dean, for instance, will take anywhere up to 20 to 50% right off the top of the grant and use it any way they like. So it not only funds the research, it funds the university in many ways as well.
I mean, there is a sense that if, and I almost hate to say this, but if there's something great to be gained, I would be more sympathetic with some place like OHSU. But if the studies are sort of just aimed at either securing grant funding or sort of making redundant tests for things that we already know, that's pretty hard to justify in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, from what I understand, and I think it would be good to talk to Matt more about it because he has intimate experience with it, they haven't had any cures in 40 years. What are the results? I mean, a lot of it seems like pure research.
Right.
In other words, it doesn't lead to anything of benefit to humans.
Right.
You can get their perspective. I've tried to get their perspective. Unfortunately, they will not agree to an interview. So what I've had to do is talk to others who have done research themselves and get their perspective. And most of them say, no, it's of no use whatsoever.
Well, and the other thing is I know that there are alternative ways to interact with these animals and treating them with respect. And still, I know about I think it's called the Great Ape Laboratory, maybe something like that. It's in Des Moines, Iowa. But essentially these researchers are like best friends with these animals. And they live there you know, almost as cohabitants in a sense, in this, you know, they have free range over this large area and they don't subject them to any kind of studies that would impair them physically or hurt them in any way.
Are they studying like language skills?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which to me is almost seems more beneficial and would give us more insights into things like how cognition works and how our language works than things like let's continue to test the studies of a known harmful substance for another decade or whatever.
Right, exactly. And also, from what I understand, they have to repeat the studies anyway on humans.
Right.
They always
right.
have to replicate their studies. Right. So it isn't as if they can go straight from an animal study to releasing a drug on the market.
Right.
And there's plenty of people that have illnesses who are willing to go through research like that and be subjects of tests. So it's a little strange to me that they have to use animals anymore, considering that.
Where do they get the animals?
Oh, they buy a lot of them. There's, you know, companies. It's a money-making operation,
yeah.
As pointed out by Dr. Ray Greek, who was a former researcher. So there's money to be made on almost every level. The food, the animals themselves, the cages, the equipment, right. The researchers.
It's a major industry.
Et cetera. It's a major industry, yeah. They also, just for people know, it's not just monkeys. They have beagles up there. They especially breed beagles because beagles are one of the most sweet-tempered dogs, easy to manage, I imagine.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. That's kind of disturbing. Can you talk about some of the other laboratory testing is only sort of the tip of the iceberg for the abuses against animals and what you address in your film. So can we talk about some of the others? I think the three other sort of main areas, correct me if I'm wrong, would be the Humane Society and the euthanization of animals that can't be placed, animals and entertainment, which I sort of include. I almost include zoos and that sort of thing in the same category. And, and of course, animals in the food industry.
Right. And we do have to include that because 90% of animal abuse, according to the Humane Society of the United States, is comprised of farm animals.
Right.
So since they comprise such a large number of abuse animals, you have to really. But let's start. You had mentioned the euthanizing, okay, which is killing.
Right.
I want to point out, we're in the film, I'm covering three local issues, and one of the local issues, a group of fellow animal rights advocates are getting together to try to influence Multnomah County to become a no-kill shelter. There are a few shelters in the United States that are no-kill, and by that it means they do not kill for any reason other than health or there is some hugely aggressive issue. But they avoid it at all costs. It is not the first resort. It is the absolute last resort. And they've reduced killing by a huge percent. And that includes the New York City shelters, which take in 50,000 animals a year. And I just read online that Austin, Texas has now become no-kill as well. So we're trying to influence our local government here to take a new tack because at Multnomah County they're killing thousands and thousands of healthy animals every year.
Well, it's largely, a question of resources. Unfortunately, I mean, we do live in sort of a country where our ethics and morality are tied up in our economics. And if these animals aren't euthanized, what are all our alternative options? I mean, other than expanding the Humane Society to be able to house more or find more effective means of placing these animals in homes?
Well, two instead of one, yeah. It really isn't a matter of that much more funding because when you use volunteers and rescues more efficiently, at least this is what's been done in the no-kill shelters that are now operative, you don't really have that much more expense. What you have is a more efficient marketing of the animals. So in other words, in New York, for instance, they have a van and they take animals out into the neighborhoods. They have free spay and neutering for pit bulls. They offer a behavior therapist who helps with training of aggressive animals. In other words, they take every effort possible to rehome, foster, or otherwise resocialize animals. a lot of times animals that come into shelters, public shelters, they're kept for 3 to 6 days. I don't know what the limit is now. I think California it's 3 days. But anyway, and then they're killed. So, you know, it's not very humane at this point in time.
Right.
And I think considering that that's our tax dollars, that we could, you know, ask for something better.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us this morning, I'm talking with Courtney Scott. She's the director of a new documentary about animal rights and the abuses against animals. It's called The War on Animals, and it's going to be coming soon to theaters. If you'd like to call in this morning to give us your comments or questions about animal rights or what you're doing to try to save animals, you can call us here at KBOO. The number is 503-231-8187. Again, that's 503-231-8187. Let's talk just a little bit more about the Humane Society and the no-kill option. Why is it that you think that the animals are so hard to place? I know there's a lot of the market for non-Humane Society animals or, you know, purebred animals or animals that are bred and sold privately is a huge industry, and a lot of people take that option for reasons which are a little bit hard to understand, considering so many of the animals that are sitting in the Humane Society at any given time. So can you talk a little bit more about why it's so hard to place these animals and what sort of the social mentality is behind that?
Well, you're right. There are a lot of breeders and a lot of puppy mills, though we've made some laws here in Oregon to kind of restrain that a little bit. But, yeah, that is a huge issue, no doubt. But the other issue is how the shelter is managed. There's always going to be issues with the way people treat animals. There's dog fighting. There's a lot of misconceptions about animals on the part of the public and the shelter. For instance, about pit bulls.
Right.
Mostly, at least 50% of the pit bulls are killed here in the Portland shelter. And a lot of that is because there's such a bad reputation for pit bulls.
And why is that? I mean, I know they have a bad reputation, and yet I don't see, you know, news of rampant pit bull attacks
right.
at all.
Yeah. I think it's a misconception. Jane Hoffman, who's the director of the New York City's Alliance for Animals in New York, said that, you know, reminded me that Petey from our gang was a pit bull. The pit bull used to be all America's favorite. So I don't know how it's evolved over time, but obviously pit bulls are very intelligent animals, and that might be why they're easier to train to do dog fighting, for instance. And so once they're in that sphere, people start to associate them with that. But in fact, they are just like any other dog, and it really depends on who their owner or their guardian is, you know, who they're around. They absorb the owner's personality and the way they're treated.
Right.
So it's turning those things around is really what we need to do in order to save lives.
Now, I know there's a lot of foster programs now popping up that are sort of innovative. Can you talk about those and how effective those have been?
Well, you know, I'm not going to claim to be an expert on all these issues, but yes, there are a lot of fosters. And I believe from the activists I've talked to on this issue that a lot more would step up to the plate and help out. They're discouraged because a lot of times at the shelters, they sometimes have a hard time getting the animals out of there. They are killed, you know, in the shelter.
Right.
They're not considered adoptable. So that's one of the issues. Now, you know, I'm not saying that I know everything about that, whether there are some needs for more rescues, but I know there are quite a few rescues out there.
Right.
So it'd be interesting to talk to a rescue and find out what their perspective is. But if you look under rescues, and just in Portland.
Right, right.
You see, there's quite a few. So I think more they could get more volunteers to help out, and I think they would do it.
It's interesting, and as we talk more about all these issues, sort of the underlying question is what rights do animals have, and how what kind of rights that humans ostensibly enjoy should be extended to animals. Now, it's interesting because we'd like to say, oh, you know, we treat humans in this very humane and a way, which of course isn't really true, and we're just as guilty as a species of genocide against our own kind, let alone animals as well. Can you address that generally a little bit? Just what rights should animals have? What should be the role of government, perhaps, in enforcing those rights? Should we have some kind of universal notion of what animals should be entitled to as just being a species that's living?
That would be the ultimate goal, is to have full animal rights, because anything short of that is what would be speciesism. And we've made headways in racism, sexism, homophobia, et cetera.
Right.
But we still think it's okay to treat animals like, well, what would you call it, third-class citizens. So, yeah, that would be the ultimate. But, of course, along that spectrum, it would be great to make steps and to have more respect, more compassion, more inclusion of animals as having some kind of influence or connection to the human. When you see animals in relationship to humans, you see a lot of healing going on. I mean, I've been to old people's homes where animals are brought in as therapy dogs, for instance, and there's a tremendous amount of healing and love taking place there. There's animals who are animal heroes. They've saved lives. Animals can sniff out cancer. I mean, we could have a much better connection with animals and have a much better connection with other humans if we learn to understand and respect animals. It was Albert Schweitzer who said, until we extend our circle of compassion to all living beings, man will not know peace. And I always wondered, you know, why is that? What is that about? And for me, what I concluded is that if you have an experience or a connection with an animal, you're experiencing unconditional love. An animal knows nothing else. That's all they can express. And if you can actually experience that, I think your chances of expanding that to other humans is much better. Because let's face it, we all judge each other. We criticize. We consistently, you know, find fault. And if we can experience something that's not like that, there's just some hope for the rest of humans. So I think that's what he, to me, that's what he meant by that.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's wonderful. And even on a just a pure pragmatic and scientific level, I mean, it's been shown that having pets extends your life, lowers your blood pressure, it increases your happiness. My father runs a nursing home, and I remember when they first got a therapy dog, and this is in the middle of nowhere, Iowa. You know, it's not a super progressive city kind of thing, and it was just life changing for so many of the residents. And this dog could, you know, he'd go and visit everyone every day, and he could adjust their beds and do all sorts of things. You could alert nurses if something was going wrong. And it was, it wasn't magical, because it obviously makes sense that we have this sort of interspecies kind of communication, but really solidified in my mind the notion of how helpful something like that can be. If you're just joining us again, I'm talking this morning with Courtney Scott, and she's a local film director whose newest film is called The War on Animals, and it's a documentary about the abuses against them and what we are trying to do to give animals their due rights. If you have a question or comment for her, please call in this morning. The number is 503-231-8187. Do you have a pet from the Humane Society? Are you a vegetarian or a vegan and bases your eating lifestyle on animal rights? Please call in and give us your experiences and your insight on this issue, 503-231-8187. Let's move on and talk a little bit about the animals in entertainment issue. Can you just give us sort of a general picture of what that looks like?
Yeah, basically animals are in entertainment. Their main issue, they're confined. You mentioned zoos. Well, right here we have another local issue, and that is with the elephants at the Oregon Zoo.
Right.
The voters of Portland passed a $125 million bond measure in 2008 with the understanding that part of that money would be used for an off-site preserve for the elephants. If you've been to the Oregon Zoo, you'll see there's 7 elephants. Now, the males are kept separate from the females, and basically, if you watch them, what they do all day is pace back and forth in a steel cage or outdoor in a yard the size of an outdoor yard in a suburban backyard. And these are the world's largest land mammals. So obviously they need space. The zoo knows this. The AZA knows this. It's now a subpar habitat for the elephants. So it really needs to happen. And yet so far it's not happened. Metro, who rules the zoo, and the zoo has say there's a feasibility study going on, and they're spending quite a bit of money on that feasibility study. So I would ask anyone who's concerned, because if you go to the zoo, just go and watch the elephants. Don't just walk past them on your way to the concession stand. Really watch them, and you'll see that they're exhibiting stereotypic behavior, which is bobbing their heads and pacing, and it's not a happy place for them. So all of those people who love Packy, Packy's been there now in April. He'll be there 48 years, and isn't it time he had some space?
I know that my first visit to the Oregon Zoo, I was actually shocked when I got to the elephant cage, and it is, it stands apart from the rest of the exhibits as sort of being especially egregious. I mean, it is literally this huge animal confined in this very small space, and I know they are making an effort to try to build out a new elephant habitat, if I'm correct. And part of it, and you mentioned the feasibility study, and I did want to say that I think part of that blame can be put on the zoo, but part of the blame can also be put on the brokenness of the nonprofit sector in a way. I know these feasibility studies, which essentially, if you don't know what that is, you spend a bunch of money, usually to hire out a consulting firm of some kind, and you do a study to see whether you can raise enough money to achieve your project, in this case, a new elephant habitat. And what that does is that says to potential funders, oh, it is possible to raise this much money in this economic climate, so funders feel more comfortable about putting their money there as opposed to giving them money and then not being able to meet the fundraising goal and not being able to build out the environment. Now, there is something kind of absurd about that, to invest all of this money into a study to see whether you can raise the money to achieve this goal. Not only is it consuming in time and resources, but it sort of seems to sidestep the goal here of the organ of, and you know, the Oregon Zoo does at least portend to be committed to conservation and animal rights and being sort of a humane organization. But when you see the elephant cage, it doesn't really appear that way in many respects.
No, it doesn't. So I think those in Portland, especially, who voted for this bond measure, should contact Metro, contact the zoo, and ask them to give a timeline. Because now recently the new zoo director was interviewed by the Oregonian, and she sounded like she really supports it. However, when asked, she didn't give a timeline. So I think it would be interesting and important for people to find out exactly when this is going to happen. Packy's 48.
Yeah.
He's not going to live to be 100.
And I believe that we have callers on the line. Marjorie, you are on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I just wanted to say that I adopted a dog from the Humane Society here recently, about 5 weeks ago. And I went online and found a dog I was interested in. Anyway, they don't use the knives anymore, and they all carry cell phones, and they are lots of volunteers. And it's very well organized, and it's very loving. And I don't know where the lady got the idea that they euthanize. They don't. They have the largest graveyard in the West Coast for animals. And I really, really love the service. And because I'm a senior citizen, I got a $50 discount, making my old dog, I adopted a 12-year-old blind dog, for $5. And they carried her to the car. They were very protective. They gave me a free collar, free vet exam, all the shots. You know, that's all. I don't want to talk too long, but that, I just wanted to say that that just happened, and it was very, very well done.
Marjorie, thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
First of all, Marjorie, thank you for doing that. That's wonderful that you adopted instead of bought a pet, so I congratulate you for that. But I want to clarify, the Oregon Humane Society is a private organization. They are not taxpayer-funded. What I'm speaking about are the public shelters, which are taxpayer-funded, and for the most part are kill shelters. And their reasoning for that is because they do have to take in every animal that comes their way, unlike the Humane Society. So when I'm speaking about the issue of no-kill, I'm speaking specifically about the public shelters.
And let's take another caller. We've got Joanne on the line. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Does anyone anywhere know about this? These military people that are coming home from the war with post-traumatic stress and brain injuries, is the VA or anybody using animals, or can they be animals can be used to help them recover from these problems? And also people in the world that have been terribly tortured or sexually abused, I wonder if any if animals can be used to help them recover, or if anybody is doing this. Anyway, thank you.
That's a very interesting question.
The only thing I know about the VA, I happen to see a program about animals in Iraq, and there's an organization that actually goes over and rescues animals from Iraq that the soldiers knew personally when they were there, and some of them have been brought back to be reunited with the soldiers who were with them there. I don't know about other specific healing or therapies with soldiers, though I would think the Delta Society would be one to contact. And there's many other therapy organizations that work with animals.
Well, the big local one is Dove Lewis, which I actually don't know that much about aside from I did have the privilege of hosting, actually on this radio show, the caretakers of Rojo the Llama, which is a therapy llama, who I also got to meet, which is the sweetest creature in the world. And if you go online and look at this photo gallery of the llama going to places like Dornbecker and Providence Child Center, and you see the child's faces as this llama walks in the room, I mean, it's magic. It's wonderful.
That's really wonderful because, first of all, not only does it help the children, but it shows there are other animals that you can connect with. I mean, it's wonderful that people love their dogs and cats. I love dogs and cats. But it's also wonderful to see beyond that and understand that all animals have a soul and have wonderful personalities and can connect with you in many different ways as well.
There was a wonderful story that I heard. Actually, it was on Radio Lab, which, not to plug another radio station, but they were talking about a rescue of a whale, and the whale was tied up in I think it was crab traps or lobster traps or something like that, and these sort of sailors went out on their own volition to rescue this whale that was just covered, tied, couldn't move, in a lot of pain, and these two divers swam over there with knives. And it took hours to cut this whale free, and the whale wasn't very happy during this whole process, and kept sort of eyeing them. And after they finally cut the whale free, the whale dove down, and then they saw this whale diving back up towards them, and they thought, oh no, you know, this is going to be painful. This whale's gonna run into us. But the whale stopped. And for the next hour or so, just went around to each one of the rescuers and just looked at them and, like, stared them in the eye. And the question was, oh, well, you know, was this animal showing gratitude? And perhaps that we can't put those kinds of human emotion labels on it, but certainly we have that connection. We understand that that is what the whale is trying to share with us, that sort of thanks.
Yes, I'd heard that story too. I love that story.
It's a great story.
It's really great. And since you mentioned whales, I just was going to segue into one other local story that I'm covering, and that's about the sea lions, which are also mammals. And right now, they are in a lethal removal program. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, along with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, is targeting sea lions because they eat salmon. And
right.
So I think people should be aware of that. There's activists that are trying to stop it. The Humane Society of the United States has a lawsuit in court. However, the killing is going forward. So I believe 5 or 6 were just killed. And these are very playful, sweet. I mean, you know, if you go out in a boat, they'll come up to you and relate to you. So I think it would be great if people would see them in a different light other than just, you know, salmon eaters.
Right. And, well, it is an interesting question how much we should be interfering with interspecies you know, populations and prey and that sort of thing. I know we have another caller on the line that I'd like to take. Sherry, you are on the air.
Hi. I'd like to thank Courtney for the work she's doing. There's a lot of criticism about people that spend their time helping animals. You know, there's human beings that need help, and that's true with both issues. But our policy in this country is a constant war on everything. I mean, whether it's war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Iran, it doesn't seem to be much difference. And thank goodness there are people that recognize the connectedness of all things. So thank you, Courtney, for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Cherry.
Let's move on and talk about probably what's one of the largest human rights issues in the country or in the world, really, which is the food industry. I'm sure everyone is fully aware of some of the egregious circumstances, factory farming, chickens who have been so genetically modified that they can't stand up because their breasts are literally making them fall forward, breaking their legs, chickens raised without feet and with clipped beaks and in conditions where they can't even move because they're literally so packed in to these barns and these feeding houses, and the way cows are treated, which this has been well documented by especially a lot of recent video footage of just really atrocious kind of treatment and conditions. So can you talk a little bit about some of those issues? And
yeah, I think one of the things people may not realize is that it's not that easy to go to a factory farm. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my history. And part of the film, I'm showing my own journey from being a complete carnivore and unaware of a lot of animal issues to being a vegan and becoming much more aware and hopefully compassionate. When I was young, my father worked in a slaughterhouse. He worked for a meatpacking company his entire life. We ate meat 3 times a day, except on Friday because we were Catholic. We had fish. But even then, I knew. Something inside of me knew that I did not want to visit my father's place of work. And in those days, you could. They had tours of slaughterhouses. If you try to get into a slaughterhouse or a factory farm today, you could actually possibly be prosecuted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And I think people should be aware of that, because why should you not know how the animals that you eat are raised and slaughtered? I think that's something that everyone should be aware of and be concerned about. The way animals are raised on factory farms is beyond cruel. It is absolutely torture because it's profit. If chickens, for instance, you mentioned, the reason they cram them in like that is the cages are a lot cheaper. Excuse me. Yeah, the chickens are a lot cheaper than the cages.
Right.
So, and especially egg-laying hens, I recommend a documentary by Mercy for Animals that investigated egg-laying farms. And the way those hens are treated is really brutal, really, really brutal.
What is the, you mentioned the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, it's an act that was basically the only congressperson who stood up and did not support it was Dennis Kucinich. And basically what the law says is very broadly written, that anyone who interferes with an animal enterprise could be subject to arrest. So depending on how the local or federal law agency reinterprets that, it could mean anything from protesting to, for instance, having videos given to you of undercover actions, to trying to get into a factory farm. You know, it's fairly broad in its definition.
If you're just joining us again, I'm speaking with Courtney this morning. We're talking about her new film, The War on Animals. If you'd like to call with a question or a comment, please do so. The number is 503-231-8187. I recently saw the movie Food Inc., which is a fantastic film, I will say. But just on the issue of not being allowed into any of these places, I mean, all the footage obtained from that film was hidden cameras and sort of moles inside of these factory farms taking the footage. I know the one woman who did let the filmmakers into her chicken houses was fired from, I think she was under contract by, I want to say, Tyson or one of those major food production companies.
Or Purdue or one of them.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah. And there's just this major veil of secrecy around this industry, especially, that is almost unprecedented in this country. The lack of transparency to the point that it's like you said, it's illegal to try to out the truth, which seems to go against everything that we've built in this country.
Exactly. I think that actually most people I've talked to in doing this film, when you ask them, they don't like factory farms. They really don't. It's trying to change their habits. That's the hardest thing for most people, regardless of what they know or don't know. Like all of us, habits are hard to change. But I think that's one thing that everyone can question, is why is there such lack of transparency in the meat industry? And there's someone who did a very good analysis and research into that, and his name is Matthew Scully, and he wrote a book called Dominion. And I think one of the other issues I explore in this film is the issue of dominion. Why do we as humans feel so, entitled to treat others the way we do?
An interesting question that I often comes up in debate in my own life is this issue of veganism versus sort of responsible omnivorism, which is the argument that, it's okay to eat other animals if they are raised and slaughtered in a quote-unquote humane way, insofar as there is such a thing as humane slaughter. So animals that come from local farms that are, grass-fed, free-range, that kind of thing. And the question really addresses, is the moral issue with how the animals are treated, or is the moral issue with using animals for food, period? So can you sort of address that? I know it's a very difficult question.
For myself personally, I'm a vegan. I don't believe killing is necessary. And in fact, there's been a lot of studies showing that animal products are actually deleterious to your health. But I will say that for everyone out there who still eats meat or wants to eat meat and feels that that's something they're going to do, it's important to know that that's a step to get meat from a humanely raised farm. I did interview a farmer down in Junction City, and that's what he does. And I respect him for his efforts, because the animals are raised on pasture. They do have a good diet. They do have freedom until that day they die. And he admitted that their death is not fun. It's not pleasant for either the person killing them or the animal himself. So ultimately, in my views, like we were talking about where you want to get to, ultimately, total animal rights, you just really couldn't kill them and still say they have rights. But in the meantime, if you can show more compassion, get your meat from a local humane farm, you're taking this step.
Well, and if nothing else, just making sure that your dollars aren't going to support it's the vote with your wallet kind of thing. Just make sure that you aren't supporting these big companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's if nothing else, because I know for a lot of people, giving up meat eating seems like an impossible.
I know.
Barrier.
In fact, I interviewed a doctor, Dr. McDougall, who's a nutritionist. And he says people tell him all the time they'd rather die than give up meat.
Right. So for those people, it's a good pragmatic step. At least if we can switch some of the market demand for the insanely cheap and really poor quality meat that is also produced through extremely inhumane and egregious
ways. Good point, because there's a tremendous amount of antibiotics that are used in meat and meat byproducts. And you have to question, what is happening to you when you eat that stuff?
Yeah.
And I just want to point out one other thing. Vegan Outreach, which is a group I support, offers a pamphlet called Even If You Eat Meat, You Can Help Save Animals. And one of the ways you can do that is another step, and that's cutting your consumption in half. You're going to be helping animals, and you're going to be helping yourself.
Right. And I want to get back to that, but we have two callers on the line. John from Eugene, you're on the air.
Thank you, first-time caller. And you guys took the words right out of my mouth. I'm an omnivore, and I don't see any better way to support animals than to buy local, buy humanely raised meat, and the rest of that. That's showing your support for not only our local farmers and helping them survive these tough times, but to supporting, you know, animals in the way, this is the way it should be done. You know, and letting people know out there that regardless, your vegetables, your meat, everything, local as well as organic and humanely raised. And there's nothing, I mean, free-ranging chicken eggs, the same sort of thing. There's nothing better. Once you've had them, I don't see how people could go back to buying the processed stuff. And then I wanted to say the book by Jane Goodall, her latest book about food and the rest of that, great reading for anyone that is interested in doing the right thing when they eat and the rest of that. Thank you guys so much. You took the words right out of my mouth when you brought up the you know, free range and humanely raised meat and so forth, and local, help our farmers. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, John. That was a good point, and I appreciate your efforts. I do want to point out one thing about veganism. The reason I became a vegan is not only the meat animals, but the dairy industry. Unfortunately, I discovered that there really is no such thing as a humane dairy. There are organic dairies, which are better because the food is better that the cows eat, but they're still kept pregnant continuously until they die. They have a very short life. They're basically milked to death. Their babies, their male calves, are taken from them at birth and sent to slaughter or to a veal calf industry. So it's really not. So all I would suggest to people is try veganism once a week. Just see, because I think a lot of times people think, oh, that's impossible. And I used to think the same. I am in no soapbox here. I was totally the same. I couldn't imagine giving up cheese. How can a person do that? But just try it once a week and just see, because believe me, the dairy industry is extremely cruel as well.
I want to make one other point. I know we have a caller on the line about buying your meat from local sort of sustainable sources. Not only is that very beneficial to try to turn the market sort of away from these mass-produced products that are very harmful to animals, but it's a great systemic solution to a lot of problems. I mean, it not only takes the market away from a lot of these companies that are terrible for the environment. I mean, these huge factory farms with all of the the methane gas that's produced from them and the waste and that's running into the streams and the antibiotics that they use, very detrimental to the environment. And not only that, the quality of their food products is so poor that it's really contributing to this vicious cycle of healthcare in a large regard. We feed people cheap, poor quality, high caloric foods like at McDonald's, which later gives them, I think, one out of two adults in a minority and one out of three adults generally will get adult onset diabetes in their life, which, of course, is just going to raise policyholders' premiums, increase the federal deficit to cover those people without insurance. So for a lot of issues, you can support your local economy, you can support and promote good health, and you can support at least a modicum more animal rights than you would be otherwise by buying local and sustainably grown produce and meat. I know we have another caller on the line. Beth, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is a subject that branches out into so many areas. I'm not vegan. I'm not really much of a meat eater, but I've had goat dairy. I have Nubians, and they have to be registered. So we have a national registry for 40 years. I also have chickens. They're free range, and I get and mix organic feed from the feed store for them. We have horses. All our animals have space, and it's always been hard for me to go to zoos, because I see, I've forgotten your first name, the guest.
Courtney?
Yes, that's right.
Courtney, it's really appalling to take a large animal and put it literally in a tiny little box, which is what zoos do. I'm calling because I had just finished a book that's just fantastic. It's called Animals in Translation by Temple Grandin. She was hired by the meat industry, that to me are like the mafia, and because they were having a lot of trouble getting the before slaughter, getting the cows, the beef cattle, excuse me, into the chutes to be killed, and come to find out, the animals knew they were going to get killed. They could see what was going to happen. And she studied them, and she is a scientist, and it's a great book on autism in animals and how they see in pictures. And anyway, just wanted to recommend that book. But I what I have to do with my, when I freshen my goats for milking, we've always had about 37. What they get freshened by a couple of bucks that I keep constantly. And then vary them like every 4 years. But if they don't have does, I can't milk. You can't milk a buck. So I would sell the bucks to the migrants for meat. And then I would go up into the migrant camps. And like you said, you can't go into places where beef is being slaughtered. They don't allow you in. Well, they also don't allow you into migrant camps to see how they have their workers and how the migrants live anymore. They've got signs up, and it's actually a felony. They can cart you off to jail. But so I can't go into the migrant camps anymore. But I don't have to. There's enough demand for goat meat. Anyway, sorry, I feel terrible calling on a show that seems to be going towards vegan. But anyway, that's my experience with animals.
Thanks so much for your call. And before we move on, I want to take a quick break to tell you what's coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 o'clock on Veterans Voice Northwest. Vets for Peace speak with Stacey Mullins, who works with veterans on dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andrea and Liam Delta host Air Cascadia. At 10:15 on Flashpoint, social critic and author Michael Parenti talks about his new book, God and His Demons. And at 11 on Radio Free Ireland Music, Mara Cullen speaks with Portland writer and musician Dave Rocket. So stay tuned for that. And again, if you're just joining us, I'm Eric Jorgensen, filling in with Annie Haynes this morning on KBOO, and I'm talking with Courtney Scott about her new movie, The War on Animals. So the caller just brought up many good points, and we've been talking for the last part of the show. And again, if you'd like to call in, we've got about 10 minutes, and the number is 503-231-8187, about animals in the food industry. Did you want to respond to the caller?
Well, you know, it's just like I said, I think anyone who's doing something to make lives of animals a little better is great. I support that. So that's really all I have to say about that.
I think something that she was talking about, how it was a felony to try to go into these to migrant camps, and just like it's a felony to go into a lot of these factory farms to film them. What has truly stricken me as being completely insane is the sort of government and legal protection a lot of these companies have, and it undermines almost everything that. Well, that I feel like we should stand for, even if we don't, as a country and as a democracy. But companies like even people who aren't necessarily engaged in animals, but just the food production industry, Monsanto, for example, can essentially sue you for not using their soybean. All of these big meat production industries, which get huge government subsidies and legal protections from being exploited. They themselves exploit migrant workers. They hire them because they're cheap labor, only to later sell them out to the DHS under what are rather kind of shady deals. Can you talk a little bit about the government involvement and support of these kinds of crimes?
Yeah, well, as we know, what happened to Oprah Winfrey and Howard
That's right.
Lyman, when I spoke to Howard, I spoke to him for my film, he told me that even though he was acquitted in that trial, the food libel law under from the Cattlemen's Association, I believe,
mm-hmm.
it still cost him hundreds of thousands of dollars in court costs.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a very expensive enterprise to take on these industries, even if you are high profile, such as Oprah Winfrey, or fairly well known, such as Howard Lyman, who wrote Mad Cowboy. You've got a job ahead of you. So most people can't do it. As you saw in Food, Inc., the small farmers who tried to take on the big industries couldn't do it. They had to back down and face, you know, bankruptcy. So, yeah, when you're dealing with the food industry, and particularly with the meat industry, even the dairy industry, you're dealing with big, big money, and they have a lot of influence. They pay Congress. You know, they buy Congress, just as the oil industry and the pharmaceutical industry do.
Well, and I mean, it's – and not to derail completely into how broken the legal system is, but the fact that it's really come down to the economics of any given situation. If you're trying to either fight a lawsuit against you for defamation of a meat producing company or something like that, or if you're trying to bring a lawsuit against a meat company for violating any number of laws, it's almost impossible simply because they have so much capital and so much money that either they will beat you by purchasing the best legal system that or team that they can, or they'll simply drag it out long enough to where it's more economically makes more economic sense for the less wealthy person to simply quit than drag it on and incur more and more legal fees that will simply put them in debt for the rest of their lives.
I mean, there's very few people who succeeded. I think the couple in England out of the McDonald's case, if you knew about that.
Mm-mm.
They actually took McDonald's on because they said they wanted McDonald's to, I forget what it was exactly, stop serving in England. Anyway, they had a lawsuit against McDonald's, and it took them, I don't know, 7 years, and they were their own lawyers. Cost them a lot of their money. They're just a poor working class couple. But in the end, they actually didn't win, but they won in a way because in the field of public opinion, McDonald's took a big hit.
Right. This is such a huge, huge issue, and we could go on for hours talking about it, and we're nearing the end of our show, and I want to talk a little bit about what people can do and moving forward from here. I do want to plug the benefit for your film, which is going to be on March 31st. That's the final day of March. It's Wednesday. It's going to be at 8 p.m. At the Parlor, which is next to Chaos Cafe down on Powell on 26th. Doors open at 7. The event starts at 8 o'clock. Come enjoy great music and watch a movie trailer for the upcoming film. That's The War on Animals. There's going to be musicians, Lisa Mann, Tim Pate, and Seth Martin. The suggested donation is $10 to help with post-production costs, but no one will be turned away. There's also going to be a silent auction to benefit the film. You can find more information about that at the website for the film, which is thewaronanimals.org. Courtney, is there anything else you want to say about the benefit at the end of the month?
No, please come on out, though. And I'm on Facebook. Oh, my God, I learned Facebook. So anyone can – it's on my links page on the website. So if you go to the links button, it'll click you right into Facebook, and you can see all about the event. And you can also bid online because the silent auction is also online on Facebook.
Great. And do you know – do you have any idea of when the film will be released?
Hopefully by this summer.
By this summer, great. Again, we're just about running out of time. I'm Eric Jorgensen. I'm speaking with Courtney Scott about her new film, The War on Animals. And if you'd like to get in one last comment or question, you're welcome to do so, 503-231-8187. Again, the benefit for this film is going to be on March 31st. Mark your calendars, 8 o'clock at the Parlor, which is next to Chaos Cafe, on which is 2628 Southeast Powell. You can find more information about the benefit, about the film, and about what you can do to help protect and further animals' rights at thewaronanimals.org. And we've got a caller on the line. Eric, you're on the air. Hello?
Yeah?
Eric, you're on the air.
Oh, right on. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on why a lot of people might not be interested in getting shelter animals, shelter dogs and stuff, cats. is because a lot of people aren't into microchips, having their animals microchipped. And that's like one of the common procedures nowadays.
That's a good point. I know I myself have a cat from the Humane Society, and he does have a microchip implant.
Well, I'm not going to say I speak for the shelters, but I would say their reasoning for that is so they can find them. If they,
right.
if the pet is ever lost, then they'll be able to track you down so you can be reunited with your pet.
Right. I understand. Makes sense, you know, on that level. But a lot of people just in general are leery of being tracked these days. And, you know, that's more and more in the media about how they're chipping animals and wanting to microchip people and for the same tracking purposes. And
yeah, well, I would definitely resist it as a human, to be honest.
Right,
just
right.
personally
yeah,
speaking.
I
but I mean,
no,
just.
I know where I stand on that one.
But if your cat gets out, or even your dog gets out of your yard and you don't know where they are, you might find that it would be useful.
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, it's you know, minuscule, this little chip. I think if you, effectively, what it does is it allows you to scan the back of the, it's usually implanted in the back of the neck, at least on cats. You can scan it. All it really has is a number on it, and you can put that number in the computer, and it'll bring up the owner's information, my telephone and address. I agree with you. It's you know, any kind of invasive sort of procedure like that can be, you know, problematic. However, just on a pragmatic level, in Portland, we have a large population of either feral cats or just outdoor living cats that roam the streets. I know my cat is an outdoor cat as well, and if he got lost, I'd be very happy to be reunited with him.
Yeah, because the fact is, if they can't find you after so many days, they are put to sleep.
Right,
killed.
Right. But thank you so much for your call and raising that very important point. And we are just about out of time, so I did want to say again, I'm Eric Jorgensen, and I've been filling in this morning for Ani Haynes. I've been talking with Courtney Scott. She is the director of the new film, The War on Animals, which will be released this summer. There's going to be a benefit for the film, again, that's going to be on Wednesday, March 31st at 8 o'clock at the Parlor next to the Chaos Cafe with music. It's a $10 suggested donation, but no one will be turned away. Come see trailers for the film and learn what you can do to help protect animals. This has been Eric Jorgensen for KBOO. Come join the website later to find the podcast of this program, among many other programs and resources at kboo.fm, Courtney's website, thewarrenanimals.org. Thank you so much for listening.